Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another exciting episode of Between the Tackles. We're right in the middle of divisional week, wildcard week, however you want to look at it, but we're right in the heart of the NFL playoffs, and we've got a very special episode here for you tonight. I'm here with my pal Manish. Manish, how you doing, and who we got coming on tonight?
Doing great, Burge. Yeah, we're really excited and happy to have former Tennessee Titans general manager John Robinson with us today. John, you know, can be described in any number of ways. I prefer to call him winner. I think that's probably the simplest way of putting it. A two-time Super Bowl champion as an integral member of the scouting department and front office of the New England Patriots. His first six seasons as a general manager were winning seasons, four playoff berths, and he will forever be known as the man who drafted Derrick Henry, future Hall of Famer, in addition to a lot of other, you know, difference-making Pro Bowl caliber players throughout his tenure. So welcome, John. Really happy to have you aboard today.
Yeah, good to be with you guys. Hope y'all are doing good.
Well, I'm doing good because my favorite team, the New England Patriots, won a nice playoff game the other night, and that happens to be where you started out your career in the NFL. And, you know, reading up on you beforehand, obviously I knew of you before we started doing this, but can you give me a little bit of background on what it was like? How did you get started? How did the Patriots pick you up to start your career as a scout? And how did that all come about?
Yeah, I was a lowly linebackers coach down at the powerhouse Nichols State in Thibodaux, Louisiana. Talk about a diamond. I don't know what to call myself, a diamond. I was more like coal in the rough. And I, you know, one of the duties, you know, when you're coaching at that level, you wear a lot of hats. One of the hats that I wore was the pro scout liaison. We didn't have a lot of prospects, guys. We had more suspects, but still the scouts would come through. I struck up a relationship with all of them. And one of them happened to be Jason Light, who was, he wasn't the personnel director. You know, Scott Pioli was there. And Larry Cook was the college director, longtime evaluator, great mentor for me. Jason was like a kind of quasi college scouting director, but I struck up a relationship with him. He asked me if I was interested in scouting. I love to recruit and find players to bring onto the team down there at Nichols. I go up and interview with Scott Pioli. He sends me back home to Thibodaux in late May and didn't offer me the job. I was making a whopping $25,000 a year as a linebackers coach. Talked it over with my wife and said, hey, if they offer us at least $35,000, we should take this job. And Scott called me 2 days later and said, John, we're prepared to make you an offer to be the Southeast Scout, and we're going to pay you a two-year contract with the first year being $40,000. And I said, looks like I'm scouting for the Patriots. So we moved to Atlanta. I scouted the Southeast for 4 years, got promoted to National Scout, did that for 2 years. And then when Thomas Dimitroff left for the Falcons GM job, Bill promoted me to college scouting director. And I ran the draft for 5 years there for Bill before leaving and going to Tampa to hook back up with Jason Light down there in Tampa.
I got to ask. What was it like working for Bill Belichick? Because all I see as a fan is what we get from those media press conferences, which I found wildly entertaining. Not necessarily somebody like Manish, who works in the media side, I'm sure, didn't feel the same way. But as a fan, I always liked the way that he interacted with the media. But can you provide some insight on that?
Yeah. I will say this. One of the first thing when we did training camp at Bryant College, and I show up, I'm the greenhorn. I got him. Yeah. But he asked about my wife and how we got moved and all that. And then our relationship kind of developed over time. He's actually really funny. He's easy to, I shouldn't say he's easy to work with, but I understood what he was asking. I understood his leadership style. He wanted everybody to be, you know, kind of a master at their craft, to be excellent in their role, be the best that they could in their role. You know, he imparted on me, I never wanted to let him down. So every time I did a scouting report, and right, listen, scouting's subjective, right? Like two people can look at a player and see him totally differently. But I never wanted to let him down with my evaluation. And I learned a ton from him. It was great working for him. I learned a lot about draft strategy. I learned about player evaluation, role-specific scouting. You know, that was where kind of I cut my teeth and I kind of learned all the fundamentals that I went on to implement in Tennessee, you know, when I got the job there.
You know, I wanted to ask you just generally, John, you know, I know plenty of scouts across the league, and it's always an interesting dynamic when I ask them, when do you know when to pound the table for a guy? Because I'm sure, you know, you see these guys in the Southeast so many times, you probably felt passionate about a lot of different guys, but, you know, you got to grab Belichick's ear in this particular case and say, look, this is a guy that I think could really help us without being the boy who cried wolf and say it, you know, for five different guys every week. So when did you know how to pick and choose and say, hey, this is a guy that I'm really going to go to bat for when I talk to Bill?
Yeah, you definitely pick your spots, Manish. You just know through working with the guy for 12 years that I did, kind of, and he didn't want you to always agree with him, right? Probably the biggest name that I continually pounded the table for as a college director was Rob Gronkowski.
Good choice.
He turned out to be pretty good. But we interviewed him at the combine, and let's just say he didn't really have a glowing first impression on Coach Belichick. And you know, I kind of stuck to my guns a little bit, and we leave the combine to go back, and it's, I'll never forget, me, Nick, and Bill are sitting in the draft room, and we had drafted Patrick Chung the year before, and Rob, who played at Arizona, went against Chung in the game. And I think, I don't know how many touchdowns he had, but Rob had a really good game against Patrick, and we thought highly of Patrick. So we're sitting there, and we're probably mid-third quarter, and Rob's got, you know, three or four catches, and he may have a touchdown or two, and he's had a couple pancake blocks. And I can hear Bill grumbling in the background, and he's like, how many more 30 visits do we got? Let's get this guy back in here. Which on his second pass, Rob didn't really impress that much either. But, you know, the rest is history. We ended up with him. He's a Hall of Fame player and was a great player for us. But I knew, like, I had a strong conviction on what we were looking for in a tight end. We kept searching for it year after year after year, and everybody always kind of came up a little short in some. And I didn't think Rob really had many holes in his game. I thought he was exactly what we had been looking for years, and turned out I was right.
Yeah, it's certainly interesting to hear you say that, because obviously as a fan, I sit here and I'm going to be like, thank you for pounding the table for Rob Gronkowski, because for 10 years I got to enjoy watching him play for the Patriots. You want to take me through what it was like early on, like, especially because when you came in, they had already won the first Super Bowl, so you were kind of already had that winning type culture coming in. What was it like, I guess, the vibe in the room when it was like, we got to repeat this success? Like, how did you guys kind of go about it? I mean, I know you were kind of just an area scout at that point early on, but what kind of vibes did you get? How did it kind of motivate you to continue to do well to make that happen?
Yeah, they had just come off the Super Bowl in New Orleans, their first one when I got hired. And when I went to training camp, you could kind of feel, to your point, you could kind of feel the vibe and the standards and the expectations had been raised. You know, it was Tom's first Super Bowl, and he was, you know, on the start to his meteoric rise to being a superstar. And you could tell, like, we didn't want to have a letdown. And, like, I don't think we made the playoffs my first year. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I thought we were supposed to win the Super Bowl. Like, I left Nichols State to come here. Like, we're supposed to be winning Super Bowls. Well, fast forward, we win back-to-back the next 2 years. So I think once the standard was set about, A, the types of players that we wanted to bring in, the caliber of players we wanted to bring in, you know, I myself as a scout took a lot of pride in the evaluations and how I articulated my evaluations. And I told our scouts once I got, you know, once I climbed the ladder in New England and then in Tampa and then certainly in Tennessee, the decisions that are made, I wanted my evaluation, when Coach Belichick read it, for him to be able to visually see the player doing what I'm describing. And he might disagree with it a little bit. He might see the value off a little bit. But I was able to paint a pretty clear picture of what he was going to bring to the table. So I always tried to pass that on because Larry Cook taught me that. Jason taught me that. And then, you know, Bill and Scott certainly reiterated that to us. So that's something that I always try to do. But you're right that after that first Super Bowl, I came in there and you could tell that the standard was going to be pretty high in that organization.
And one final question before we move off the Patriots here. What was it like? Because obviously the Patriots through that, obviously through the 20 years, but like through your time there, they were always picking late in the draft, late in the rounds and everything, and still sustained success through that period of time. How did that change your mentality? Like, because, you know, usually you go through the ebbs and the flows of the cycle of the NFL where you end up picking high and then you kind of, it's the kind of that rotate, that circle of life in the NFL. Consistently picking late in the draft presents a lot of challenges, doesn't it?
It does if you don't have Tom Brady. You know, that he certainly solved it. He certainly erased a lot of issues that we had. But you're right. You know, typically, you know, I think it's always comical around, you know, as it inches closer to the draft, you know, everybody wants to poll the GMs and how many first round grades, do you have on a player? It's like, well, we've only got 17 guys graded in the first round. And like, we weren't so concerned about what round, you know, if you're going to pick, if you're not going to trade, then like you're trying to take a player that is going to have hopefully a starting role if you take him in the first round. And, you know, hopefully if you stumble into an impact player back there, I mean, DeAndre Hopkins went 28 or 29. He's been one of the better receivers over his career. I think if you just identify the skill sets of the players and you have a staff, which Bill always did, that could – maximize the skill set of the player and put them in position so that they could be really good at what they do. You can't just plug them in anywhere and expect them to go make an impact. But Bill was extremely efficient at identifying where the player was going to impact the team the most and try to put those players in those positions and keep them out of situations where they weren't going to be, you know, as impactful.
John, I did want to sneak in one last Patriots question. I believe the first year that you were promoted to director of college scouting, you guys drafted Edelman in the, you know, on day three.
Seventh round.
So, when you're talking about seventh round picks, there's a lot of, you know, potential picks, you know, what a guy might be, a project. Obviously, you know, I don't think that you guys could have envisioned the career that Edelman wound up having, but can you kind of take us through the homework on Edelman and what the thinking was when you guys ultimately pulled the trigger on him for that pick?
Yeah. He was a quarterback at Kent State, right? So, you knew from there was a lot on his plate from a mental standpoint of knowing the offense, understanding the defense to get the offense in an advantageous play so that the Kent State offense could go. It went through Jules and, you know, he was undersized as a quarterback, but he was extremely tough. He was really good with the football in his hands. And we knew he was going to be a developmental player. You know, when you pick in the seventh round, it's not like you expect him to go on and be a Pro Bowl caliber player. So that's really a testament to Julian and the way that he worked. I think he was on the practice squad and then he got called up and then he went back to the practice squad. I mean, he yo-yoed back and forth between the active roster and the practice squad a couple times, I think. But he just kept grinding, as they say, and carved out a niche for him. You know, we had the market cornered on slot receivers, whether it was Troy Brown to Welker to Amendola to Jules to, and we tried a Danny Woodhead out there some. So, you know, I think that we identified he was good with the ball in his hands. He was extremely tough. He was intelligent. He was a very hard worker. And then he made himself into, you know, kind of a superstar. And much like Tom did. Tom went, 199? He was a sixth-round pick. It's not like he was the first overall pick in the draft, but talk about a guy who was meticulous with his mechanics and studying the game and trying to ID what the defense is going to do to him pre-snap so that he could get him in a play and he knew where to put the ball. You know, that mindset carried its way really with every player on the team, from Tom to Vrabel to Brewski to all of those guys. It was kind of a theme that we wanted these tough, hardworking, grinder type mindset guys that were going to maximize, you know, their opportunity, and then the coaches were going to put them in a position where they could be successful.
I'll always remember the Wally Pip with Julia Edelman and Wes Welker, with Bill Belichick on the sideline asking if Welker if he had ever heard of Wally Pip.
Yeah.
Classic.
John, I mean, I think one of the things that I've always respected about you is that, you know, you really did start at the grassroots and you earned every promotion that the Patriots gave you, so much so that you stayed there for the better part of a decade, and then ultimately moved on to Tampa to be their director of player personnel for a few years. By the way, you guys drafted future Hall of Famer Mike Evans while you were in Tampa. But then you get the opportunity that everybody in your business wants, and that's to sit in the big chair, general manager for the Tennessee Titans. Really an unusual circumstance in that you get there, the interim coach is Mike Mularkey, the ownership wants to promote him to full-time head coach. And then I thought you made a very bold decision, and I thought it was a gutsy decision. It's a decision that I know that people at the time, and even looking back now, thought it was the right decision, and not a decision that many general managers would make, which is move off the head coach, Mike Mularkey, after you guys made the playoffs, to hire somebody who you thought could take the franchise to the next level, and that was Mike Vrabel. So I wanted to talk to you about that 2018 coaching change from Mularkey to ultimately hiring Vrabel. Mike and you had spent about 7 years, I believe, in New England, won those two championships together as part of the Patriots organization. So just your mindset and saying, hey, look, yeah, we made the playoffs, but I think we can do better. And this is the guy I think we can do better with. So can you just kind of take me through your mindset going from Mularkey and why you chose Mike Vrabel specifically?
Yeah, those are never easy decisions, right? When you're going to make change, and there's a lot of discussion that goes on with, ownership, team president, there's a lot of voices that are involved in those big decisions like that. And then ultimately as a team, we decided that, we were going to make a change. And, that year we had identified three candidates, Mike Vrabel, Matt LaFleur, and Steve Wilks. Those were the three guys that we interviewed. I knew Mike's presence. I knew, his toughness. I knew he was extremely football smart. I knew that, he had an edge to him, but he had a personality that was likable. I just felt like that there was something there. It's not like they were really setting the world on fire defensively in Houston. They were a good team, but it wasn't like they were number one in every category. But I just knew what his makeup was, and I knew what he stood for. And then on the interview, you could see the command he was going to have in the room. The fact that he was a former player and he could create touch points with players on our team, and he was relatable. I mean, he was a All-American, then he was a third-round pick, and he didn't really play a whole lot in Pittsburgh. He played on special teams, and he kind of earned his way into a starting role in New England, and then he went on to be a Pro Bowl player. So he played outside linebacker. He played tight end. There's really not a lot of things that he hadn't done that he wasn't going to ask the players sitting in the room to do, right? So at the end of the day, all three candidates were excellent. I think Steve Wilks ended up getting the Cardinals head coaching job that year. We ended up with Matt LaFleur as our offensive coordinator, and then a year later he gets the Green Bay job. So I think we identified three really good candidates. All have gone on to be head coaches, but it just felt like Mike was the most ready to lead our team. And I felt like that, it was just going to be a good fit for us here.
Did you have specific questions that you were really curious about? Because that's, that's one part of the process that, I think the average fan doesn't know, unless you talk to candidates, if you're in the media and you find out what questions they asked, what specific questions were you really interested in hearing their answers to?
Yeah, I think I do a lot of interview prep now with coaching candidates, with GM candidates. And I tell them the most important time in the interview is the first 10 to 15 minutes, right? Because there's a reason the job is open, right? Something is broken within the football business, right? They're not winning, or something's awry. So I think first and foremost, you have to, you know, the candidate has to come across as somebody that you want to talk about football with on a daily basis, right? You just want to have conversations about it. Because if you don't want to talk to somebody, it's probably not going to go well, no matter how well the coach is, how good the coach is, right? Mm-hmm. So being able to have conversations, have a conversational tone in that first 10 or 15 minutes, and then really you're just building, you're asking them questions about, you know, like what does culture mean to you? Like, what is your plan for structuring practice? How are you going to coach the guy that's a 10, 12 year veteran different than the rookie free agent that we signed out of Washington State? Like, how are you going to create touch points with the different demographics that make up a locker room? How are you going to impart on the players that you have a plan individually for them in their career so that they can be successful? And if they're successful players on our football team, then pretty fair to surmise the team's going to be pretty good. You're going to win games, which in turn is going to help them either get more money with our team or go get paid somewhere else. Like, that's the nature of the NFL. That's the business of the NFL. So being able to create those touch points through conversation, through questions, but it all starts with the first 10 or 15 minutes that I just want to talk to this guy about football, you know? And if you can't nail the first 10 or 15 minutes, then really you're just wasting each other's time for the next 2.5, 3 hours, however how long the interview goes.
It's certainly interesting to hear you say that, because obviously you had familiarity with Mike Vrabel from being in New England for all those years together. Now, I'll tie it back to Bill Belichick a little bit here. Do you see a lot of similarities between Mike Vrabel and Bill Belichick when you were interviewing him? Did you see any kind of, you know, that Patriot way still kind of ingrained in him when you made the decision to hire him?
Yeah, I think so. I think we all learned a lot from Bill, right? But I think, and again, having not worked for the organizations with guys that left and ran their own programs, I think the mistake that's often made is they try to be Bill.
Right.
And to me, like I always said, if I had an opportunity to run a football team, like I'm going to take all of the things, you know, the master's degree that I earned learning and working under Coach Belichick, but I've got to be me, right? Mm-hmm. I've got to be my own personality. I was like, we're going to work hard, and like, it's going to be a tough program, but we're also going to have fun. Like, every day is not going to be gray when we walk into the building, right? The sky is not always falling. So, cause the NFL is a hard business. It's hard to win an NFL game. And when we do win, again, not every week is a Super Bowl when you win a game, but like, you got to celebrate sometime, right? You got to have a little bit of fun with it. So I think that Mike did a really good job in the interview of, similar to what I did to get the job in Tennessee, conveying all of the fundamental principles that we learned about, you know, roster building and team building, and on his end, coaching, but being your own personality, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I'd say that's definitely big, because I've definitely heard of other coaches that had coached under Bill where they've kind of gone off and they tried to replicate, almost try to do the exact same thing, and it hasn't worked. And, you know, I kind of base that in my own life, in my own career, where it's like, I'm going to take what I learned from you, the best parts, I'm going to take the best parts from what I learned from you, and I'm going to combine it together. I'm going to create me. It's kind of the same thing exactly with what you're saying there.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's the only way you can kind of attack, you know, really any career field that you're going to be in. You got to be your own person. You got to be comfortable in your own skin. If you're trying to be somebody else, then you're just faking it. And at the end of the day, that's going to come through, and you're going to lose, you know, credibility with those, you know, those that you're working with in any industry.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think it's easy to see how Mike Vrabel would be relatable. It is funny because You obviously know him much better than both of us do, but you know, in my interactions with Mike in the past, it's really funny because he has a way of genuinely being interested in the person that he's talking to. You know, whether it's a reporter, whether it's you know, his general manager or players, you know, other media that cover him on a day-to-day basis. It's really fascinating. I think there's a general curiosity about him. I think he's genuinely a curious person, and he wants to know more about you as a person. And you know, I share this story all the time. When I first met Mike at you know, one of the owners' meetings, I don't know if it was his first year in Tennessee or maybe his second year, but he was literally the only coach to that point who had asked me about my career. Because you know, my job is typically, you know, asking general managers like you or head coaches like Vrabel about, you know, their background, their, you know, their upbringing, you know, what makes them tick, why did they get into the profession. And it's rare when unprompted, you know, a coach or an executive asks you, like, you know, why did you get into reporting? You know, where did you go to school? Where are you from? You know, why choose this particular field? I just was very impressed by that, just on a human level, the fact that he was genuinely curious. And I think that curiosity serves him well as a coach, specifically dealing with his other coaches and dealing with players, many players who are much younger than him. And as much as the football acumen has gotten him to this point, I think that his you know, his genuine curiosity as a person has benefited him so much in becoming a highly successful head coach. I just wanted to get your thoughts on that as well.
Yeah, just don't slip up or he'll cook you.
Yeah, you see that. Look, and it's funny because it's almost playful. You know, he's had some back and forth with some of the Boston media in his first year with the Patriots. But there's a tone to it that isn't abrasive, and it's actually engaging. And again, I'm looking at it from the outside in, not being in Boston, but I just find him to be a very welcoming person. But you're right. I mean, there is a hard edge to him. You can't, it's not all, you know, rainbows and, you know, peaches and cream in the NFL, but I do like that part of who he is. And I think that also really has served him well in finding the success that he had with you in Tennessee and then obviously now in New England. So you had this time with him, and look, you talked about preparing candidates for interviews now. You have had general manager interviews with Jacksonville and the New York Jets last year, so you're well versed in this entire process. And we're looking at, you know, 9 head coaching openings right now. You know, the 9th coming, you know, today with Mike Tomlin, you know, stepping down, likely going into the media, but we'll see. When you look at these 9 openings, what are, you know, the 2 or 3 that you think are the most desirable? I mean, obviously every head coach wants to get a position because there's only 32 of them. But when you look at the, you know, these 9 openings, what are the, you know, the, maybe the 2 or 3 that you think, wow, this would be a great job to jump into?
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's crazy how the turnover in head coaches has really, ballooned from, you know, 2 or 3 a year to then it goes to 4 or 5 a year. And now we're looking at over a quarter of the league is going to have a new head coach next year, right? Everybody in the AFC North, except for Zach Taylor, it's going to be a new head coach. So I think when you're looking at a team and where to go, it's you're looking at ownership, right? And what's that going to be like working with on a daily basis? You're looking at the roster, like what pieces are there? What pieces do we need? Certainly the quarterback position, which is the hardest position, you know, to get right in the National Football League. Who do you have in place, or is there an option either via the draft or in free agency to get one? Do we have the cap space to go buy one if we've got to buy one? Are you aware of any trade potentials, right? So you're looking at all of those situations. What's the general manager's status? You know, it's hard to circle, you know, one and say, you know, this one's better than that one, right? There's only there's 32 of them in the world, right? So I would say you're in rarefied air if you get one, because they're hard to get. I think they all have their challenges, but you know, I mean, I would say when I got to Tennessee, I mean, we took over a team that had won 5 games in 2 years combined, and it was like, ugh, there's not a lot to work with there, right? But we came in with a plan, and like, here's what we're going to do, and we started to, you know, activate that plan with trading for DeMarco Murray and then trading the first pick and starting to stockpile picks. So I think, you know, who are you working with in the GM chair? Because there's only one of those openings now, right? Atlanta. So who are you working with in the chair? What's the strategic plan for the football team? Do our philosophies align? You know, if you want to run the ball as a head coach, if you believe in, you know, kind of what Houston's kind of trying to do with run the football and play great defense, and the owner wants to throw it all over the yard, it's probably not going to be a good fit, right? So you've got contrasting philosophies from the jump. So to say which one's best, I don't know. I mean, I think some of the rosters obviously look a little bit better than others on paper. But there's been a lot of good-looking rosters on paper that didn't make the playoffs, or they're one and done in the playoffs too. So it'll be interesting to see how 9 get filled as all this stuff shakes out over the coming weeks.
Yeah, I'm going to show my East Coast bias, my New York bias, and ask you specifically about the New York Giants opening, because no, they do have stable ownership with the Maras, and they do potentially have a budding young difference-making quarterback in Jackson Dart, and they also appear to be making a full-court press on John Harbaugh. So my question to you is, how much sway, you know, if you're a candidate, would having Jackson Dart be? And then secondly, and perhaps more importantly, you know, John Harbaugh is probably the most coveted candidate during this cycle, you know, for obvious reasons, for, you know, sure, what he's done for the better part of 2 decades. I would think that the Giants, the Falcons, you know, other teams, even Tennessee, I believe, who's interested in interviewing him, would have to sell themselves as much as he would have to sell himself to the team. He's in a rare position where he will have options. So if you're the general manager of a team that wants John Harbaugh, how do you say, hey, you know what, you've got other good options here, but my team is the best option? How do you sell a guy like that on your program?
Yeah, I think you talk about with what you've, you know, the Atlanta's a unique situation, right? They just hired Matt Ryan, and they're going to hire a general manager. You know, Tennessee has Borgonzi in place, who comes from Kansas City. So, you know, I think you do sell, at least within all three organizations, have quarterbacks, young quarterbacks on rookie contracts, right? So you've got some flexibility cap-wise to navigate adding players to the team. I think all three have, you know, different stars at different positions. You know, in Tennessee, you've got Jeffrey Simmons, who I drafted, who's a superstar defensive tackle. In Atlanta, you've got Bijan Robinson, who's arguably the best running back in the league. And then in New York, you've got a really good defensive line. You got Malik Nabers coming off an injury, who had a great rookie season. So there's some superstar pieces in place. I think you have to sell the relationship with the GM, how you're going to go about building the roster, how you're going to be collaborative with them, how you're going to how you evaluate prospects, how you want to lean into the coach to find players that fit his system. You know, it'll be up to ownership how they delegate the powers, right? Like, if Joe has control over the 53-man roster in New York, does he say, hey, we really want John Harbaugh, I'll give John Harbaugh the control over the 53-man roster, let me have control over the 90 guys that start on the team? You know, all of that stuff, I think, is up for discussion with each individual club, is how they want to, you know, delegate the powers in order to woo him to their club.
I want to take it back for a second, because, you know, we're talking about an absorbent amount of openings. We got 9, like we said, we got 9 this year, and there's been a little bit of a theme, I want to say, over the last, I don't know, 5 to 8 years of the league. I'll just throw an arbitrary number out there, but where teams are often very quick to pull the trigger on getting rid of a coach. You know, the Patriots did it last year, obviously with Gerard Mayo, that worked out for them. You know, a team like Vegas has seemingly gone through coaches at will. So I wanted to just bring that up because you talked about activating your plan, coming in with a plan, activating and executing your plan. And as we know, those plans take time to put into place. So when it comes time to make a decision where it's like, okay, maybe it's time that this isn't working, let's move on. How do you make that kind of that determination to do that when you know that when you're putting your plan in place that you have to, there's got to be some runway to work through the kinks of putting that plan into place?
Yeah, I think each individual situation is unique, and I don't, unless you work in the building day to day and you're around, you know, the head coach, it's hard to get a grasp on why decisions are made per se, right? Like Pete Carroll got 1 year. Pete's a hell of a football coach. Mm-hmm. Won a lot of games in Seattle. He got 1 year. Like, what was the reasoning behind, you know, that fast of a move off of Pete? Like, I don't know. Like, none of us really know because we're not in that building every day, right?
Right.
So, I think those that question is kind of hard to answer or really give a, you know, a true factual answer on because you don't know their inner workings of what's going on. Is it a lack of development with younger players? Is mm-hmm. it managing the older players and how, you know, we're taking care of them? Is it the staff's not getting along? Is it we're arguing about personnel all the time? Like, what is it? What are the factors that ultimately lead to a change in the position?
That definitely makes a lot of sense too, because you think that there's not going to be necessarily one reason that a decision like that is made. Because you know, you can look at somebody team like the New York Jets, who had a horrible season this year, but are sticking with their head coach to go forward to kind of allow the GM and the head coach to execute their plan. And you know, giving a little bit of time. And I just thought it's been an interesting thing because I was always like, when we were talking about the Patriots last year, I was like, no, I don't really care to be one of these organizations that is like, you know what, I'm just going to start cycling through coaches every year and not be able to build anything when you have that. Turns out the decision was the right decision for the Patriots, given where they are now.
So you're saying they're glad you didn't make the decision.
Exactly. Yes. That's why I'm sitting here and I'm not sitting down at one Patriot place right now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So how do you balance this notion, which I subscribe to just generally in life, that you know, experience is the best teacher. So would you go after a guy who has had previous head coaching experience? And I hate the term retread because I frankly think that guys can hit the ground running on their second job. I mean, you know, Bill Belichick is a perfect example of that, versus, you know, the hot young candidate that everybody seems to want because there's always a intrigue in the unknown. You don't know what someone's going to be. There's always this hope in the back of your mind that maybe he's the next Sean McVay. In all likelihood, he won't be. But there's this shiny new toy versus maybe a guy who, you know, doesn't grab headlines but would be better for your team. And I'm talking about guys like Mike McCarthy, most recently Kevin Stefanski, Mike McDaniel got let go. Obviously, we talked about John Harbaugh versus some of the younger guys. You know, you've got Shula in L.A. You've got Clint Kubiak. People like to talk about the job he has done, and he's done a great job in Seattle. The younger guys like Jesse Minter on the defensive side of the ball. So, I mean, where do you fall on this notion of getting the young up-and-coming guy or the experienced guy who I don't believe is not up-and-coming? You can still be a rising candidate and somebody whose trajectory is up. Just because you got let go in your previous experience doesn't mean that you're suddenly, you forgot about football. If anything, I think, again, the experience helps you. So where do you stand on, you know, experience versus first-time coach?
Yeah, I think some of the best life lessons that we learn, regardless of the industry that you're in, whether it's in football, whether it's in reporting, plumbing, electrical work, whatever. I mean, get shocked one or two times as an electrician, and you're probably going to learn from your mistake, and you're going to wire it a little different, right? So I think you make a great point. Like some of the best lessons that you learn are the mistakes that you made. Yeah. And to your point, like just because it didn't work, why did it not work at your first stop, or what went awry at your first stop? Was it you? Was it something else? And what did you learn from the experience so that you don't make the same mistake the second time if given the opportunity, right? And I think when you spin around the league, you know, I find it fascinating that coaches are often, and this isn't me politicking for myself, right? But like Andy Reid, 2-time head coach, right? Dan Campbell was interim, but got a second chance. Vrabes, 2-time head coach. Sean Payton, 2-time head coach. So there's a lot of coaches that get that second opportunity. And like, how many Super Bowls has Andy won in Kansas City? You know, he was a really good coach in Philadelphia. Something kind of got sideways there. He lands in Kansas City, and he's a Hall of Fame coach, right? So I think you make a great point. And with the young coach, you know, the argument there is, would you rather be a year too early or a year too late, right? Because if you don't pull the trigger on a young coach, yeah, you may take some lumps your first year, but you could have the next Sean McVay or the next greatest thing, the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, as long as he's going to be the coach. So that's where you have to do your due diligence. That's where you do all your background work, you know, calling on coaches, getting people's opinions that have worked with them on a daily basis. What are they made of? What's important to them? How do they work with the players? All of that background information is important. But ultimately, it's up to, you know, each individual team and what fits them specifically, where they're at with their current setup, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I think it's interesting you bring up Sean McVay there, because we talked with, I think it was Tom Pelissero about a month or so ago, and we brought this up, and you talk about wanting to be a year or two too early. You don't want to be necessarily when this guy is going to be quote unquote ready to be a head coach in the league in 2 years. You don't want to be going through this whole process again at that point. So it's almost like you give that runway. And yeah, you may take your licks early on, but giving it that time to mature, you could end up with a, you know, the gold, like you said, Sean McVay. It's yep. It's a very interesting concept there. I'd like to move it along to the current playoffs where we sit now in the NFL. I want to get your, first of all, while we're talking about it, I want to get your take on the games this past weekend, because I, as a fan of the league, some outstanding football games. Save the game, you know, last night, Monday night. That was probably the only one that, for me, was lacked that entertainment factor. But the rest of the games really were entertaining football games.
Yeah, they did. I mean, it came down to the last series or the last couple plays in most every game. I thought the Chicago Green Bay game was super exciting. The Jacksonville game was in Buffalo was super exciting. You know, and the NFL as a league, that's exactly what they want, right? You've got some new fans, you know, whether it's Jacksonville or, you know, Denver's kind of been on, you know, the schneid for a little bit. You know, they made a great run when Elway, but now they're back in it. They're the number one seed. You got the Patriots who were, you know, riding high for all those years, and then they have a little bit of a down spurt. Now they're back in it. So all the fans now feel like they have a chance, right, to hoist the trophy. And the entertainment value that the games provided this weekend, it just threw fuel on the rabid fire that is the National Football League, right? It's like a great movie. You're sitting there and you're waiting for the cliffhanger or the ending, and it delivered. And, you know, I joke all the time now that, you know, yes, when I was with the team, like, you hanging on pins and needles because it's your job, it's your career. But now that I've been out for a couple years, at the end of the day, it's the entertainment business. Like, it's a notch above the WWF and all that, but it's all entertainment, right? Like, people are going to spend their money on something. You're either going to spend it on a nice dinner and a movie, or you're going to buy the NFL Sunday ticket and sit at home with your own beer and your own rack of ribs that you pull off the smoker and enjoy that. So, a great product, extremely suspenseful, and looking forward to watching this weekend's games.
The wild card weekend, since they added that seventh team, this felt like the best one. Like, it may be a little bit of recency bias there when I'm saying that, but it always seemed over the last, I don't know, 5 years or whenever they added it in, that there were a lot of dud games. You know, there were a lot of blowouts, and it was like, well, we're moving on. But this year, given the playoff fields, especially in the AFC, you got no real juggernaut. All these teams have flaws that could be fatal to them when the time comes. We saw Jacksonville, you know, go down the 3 seed. A lot of people were riding high on them going into the playoffs. You know, every team has a potential flaw. And for me, as a fan of the whole thing, I love it, because it's like, there's no Chiefs. There's no Patriots of old. There's no like, oh, one team's going all the way to the Super Bowl every year like it had been. So, you know, I want to get your take on these upcoming games that are coming up here with the divisional round. Which game would you say for yourself is the most intriguing matchup?
Well, I got to go back first. The best wild card for me personally was I think it was the 19 season.
I was trying to avoid that one.
When we knocked off the king himself in his home stadium, the lowly hillbillies from Tennessee trot up and dethrone the two kings and Belichick and Brady.
Ended the dynasty.
And then we go on to Baltimore, the vaunted Ravens, and Lamar Jackson, and we thump them, kick them in the mouth, and looky, who's in Kansas City, and we stubbed our toe in Kansas City. I think we could have beat them, but we didn't.
I was right on the bandwagon that year. I was right on the bandwagon against the Chiefs that year. I was right there.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think this weekend's games are going to be excited. I'm excited to watch not so much teams but players. Like, can Josh Allen – you know, can he roll? How does Bo Nix, you know, his first crack at it, how does he handle? Can Sam Darnold keep it up the way he's been going? How does San Fran in Seattle, what does that look like? You know, that was a really good game, the last game of the season where, you know, Seattle came out on top. But, you know, this San Francisco team, I mean, they are gritty now. I mean, they're kudos to Lynch. I mean, he's signing guys off practice squads. It's like that year in 2020 where, you know, I would take a lap through the Burger King to see if anybody looked like they could play. We had so many guys hurt. Probably an in and out for Lynch. But, yeah, I think you've got a bunch of really cool, you know, matchups, a lot of intriguing matchups. And it'll be another exciting weekend of NFL football.
I just want to take you back real quick. Something that you said a moment ago, John, about you know, second year head coaches and you know, the experience the first time around really helping them in their second job. It's an interesting dynamic in the NFL world. I've always felt this way, you know, for 15 some odd years, that, you know, head coaches will get second opportunities. Some of them will get third opportunities. General managers, however, it's very difficult. I mean, it happens. You know, I covered Mike Tannenbaum in New York, and then he ultimately got another opportunity in Miami. But by and large, it is challenging to get that second opportunity in a front office. And I would think, just based on the general managers that I have known throughout the years, that having a 3 or 4 or 5 or 6, you know, in your case, seven years of experience at the position would be invaluable to a team looking for a new general manager, simply because you know the ins and outs of being in that position. You know, everybody that I've talked to who has become a first-time general manager talks about, wow, this is so much different than being the director of player personnel or being a scout. There's so many different responsibilities that you don't truly understand until you're actually living that position. So the fact that you have that experience, to me, should be such a benefit for an owner looking for a new general manager. But there is this odd dynamic in the league where it's difficult, you know. And I've talked to guys who have been general managers and then had interviews for second opportunities, and they will admit that it's challenging. I always just found that to be odd. So somebody in your position who, again, general manager for 7 years, first six seasons, winning seasons, four playoff teams, guy who, as I said off the jump, drafted Derrick Henry. You made a masterful trade in Ryan Tannehill. You had mentioned that 2019 run that you guys had. That was because Tannehill took over for Marcus Mariota. You've had some master strokes as a general manager, to which I would say, if I'm an owner looking for a general manager, those types of decisions to me would give me comfort. So I just want to get your thoughts on why is it challenging for executives to get a second opportunity as opposed to head coaches?
Actually, I'll correct you first. Seven winning seasons. Never had
seven.
A losing
season.
I was 7-5 when I got fired in December. So
okay.
We were in first place in the division. Correct. We would have won the division again, Manish. We would have had three back-to-back AFC South titles. I digress. I think you bring up a point. I've brought it up before. And, guys like myself and Thomas Dimitroff, who I thought did a great job in Atlanta in building that team. I mean, they went to a Super Bowl. I wish I had the answer. I wish I knew what it was. Maybe we're thought of as dinosaurs. We're antiquated in our way of scouting with the new, analytics and all of this stuff that plays into it. When the reality is, I was doing some analytical stuff in New England when I was a college director. So I don't know the answer to that. I've had a couple opportunities. I interviewed, like you said earlier, I interviewed in New York last year. Feedback that I got was great. I don't know if it's they're wanting to make the pairing with the head coach and the GM. I don't know if there's an intimidation factor if you're going to hire a rookie head coach and you got this existing GM who's been there and done it before. I would think that would be a plus, right? Because I can share experiences that, I worked with two head coaches, right? And here's things that I should have done better as a GM in working with those guys. Here's a couple things they should have done better. I've got some scrapes and scars, and I'm still walking. I'm still kicking. I've got experiences. I've got knowledge. I know how to manage people. I know how to create culture. Like the culture, we established that in 2016 when I first got there. Like there was a certain way we were going to do things. And then when we brought, Vrabes in, he just accelerated that culture. The foundation had kind of been laid, and he did a great job of taking us to where he took us to. But to answer your question, I don't know what the bias is against your second time GM candidates. There were a lot of us that were worthy of interviews. I think Thomas has interviewed a couple times. I was the only one that interviewed in Jacksonville last year, the only second time. So, they made what looks like the right decision, at least now, with the structure they have in place, with Tony and Gladstone there. And I think Liam's a great coach. I worked with Liam on a lot of prep stuff, getting him ready for that job. So I personally had an answer of what is the bias against, not to steal your term, but a retread GM, to give a see what this guy's about and what did he learn. That would be one of my first questions as an owner, is like, looking back on what you did, what did you do really well, and then what are some things that where you thought you could have been better, and how would you go about not making those mistakes again?
Yeah, I hate the retread connotation. I just think it's unfair. I've always thought it was unfair. I think it's kind of ridiculous. Probably a different podcast, a different time for, a different time for a different conversation. I did want to get your thoughts real quick on the notion of, college football general managers. You're seeing guys in the NFL, move in that direction. I don't know if it's most recently, but recently, David Caldwell, former Jacksonville Jaguars general manager, is now the GM at the University of Florida. Just what do you think of that movement? And just the notion of that structure of having a general manager in place for college programs.
Yeah, I think that there's certainly some, you know, there's some parallels, but I think that's a world that's uniquely different with this NIL market, right? Because you're having to basically re-recruit the kid or re-sign the kid every single year. You know, you think you have an agreement, but then the kid ends up jumping in the portal and you think you've got the guy. Now you don't have the guy, you know, at least with the NFL, you know, unless you're just going to sign a guy to a 1-year contract, if you draft the guy, then you've got the guy for at least 4 years. Right. Yeah. And like, you know what you're working with and you know what you're building. I do think that from an evaluation standpoint, from a leadership standpoint, there's certainly some colleges that have looked at the NFL model about allocation of resources towards certain positions. You know, obviously if you just look around of who's getting paid, you know, these college quarterbacks are making $4 or $5 million a year now. So that's the highest position on the college roster, much like it's the highest paid position on NFL rosters. And then you look at, you know, tackles, receivers, edge rushers. It's a similar model. It's just a different roster building strategy in my mind, because you've got so many guys that you have to pay, and the volatility of them just deciding, well, I don't like this coach anymore, I'm going to go in the portal, or I think I can get an extra $50,000. And you're not really dealing with licensed agents, right? Some of these guys, it's their uncle's friend who owns a car wash, you know, and it's like, you really don't know the negotiating strategy. It's like buying a used car from the, you know, seedy used car lot on the side of the road. So, I've entertained it. I've thought about it. I don't know if that makes sense for me at this point in my career. I'll be 50 this weekend. So I don't know if I have the patience to deal with a 17-year-old kid.
Trying you got to haggle me over 50 grand. You're only halfway home, John. Sweet, you have plenty of time. just to jump back real quick, you said something interesting that you'd help Liam Cohen during the interview prep. How did that come about? And what do you think the best piece of advice you gave him was?
No, so that's kind of what – so I've been working with Wynn Sports Group now for the last 2 years. So I do interview prep for all the guys that we sign, you know, preparing them for all-star game interviews, for combine interviews, for 30 visits.
Great.
So it, there's not a question. I tell all the kids that I work with, I had 5 on tonight. There's not a question that you're going to be asked that I haven't asked before. I watch film with them. I do install with them. I basically prepare them for when they go to the combine and the gauntlet that they're going to run, what to expect. And I get a lot of pride out of when I get a text from Brock Bowers and he walks out of an interview room and he said, they try to get me on this question, but you already had me ready for it. Thank you.
Like, oh, that's awesome.
That makes me feel good that I've helped those guys, because they're trying to achieve their dream, right? They want to play in the NFL. So it's similar on the head coach and the GM. I had a call last night with a head coaching candidate, kind of talked him through, you know, some things to be ready for, some things to expect. And Liam was great last year. You know, we talked through the roster at Jacksonville. I talked through him of probably how the format's going to roll with the interview. I talked about that first 10 minutes, making sure – I mean, if you think about it, I don't know if either of you guys are fishermen, but like if you don't, you didn't strike me as the next Bill Dance, Manish.
No.
I don't even know who Bill Dance is, but he's a legendary fisherman. He's a legendary fisherman in Tennessee. He had a TV show way back in the 80s. But like, they're fishing, right? And like, if you don't get the hook in the owner's mouth in the first 10 or 15 minutes, they're going to swim off. So like, you've got to do something to get the hook in them. And then you're just laying out your plan for the next 2.5 hours. So really driving that point home with candidates to make a great first impression. It's no different than when you go on a date. If you really like somebody, in the first 10 or 15 minutes, you're going to know if you kind of like them or not. I mean, I've been married for 24 years and it's like, kind of knew I liked my wife in the first 10 or 15 minutes. If not, we wouldn't have been married for 24 years.
I hope you didn't peak after those first 10 or 15 minutes. You know, that would have been a rough 23 and a half years or so.
Yeah. Oh, no, we're going strong. But like, it's so important. And, you know, it was really good working with Liam. You know, I've worked with several guys, GM candidates, head coach candidates, and I was extremely blessed. Good Lord's been good to me. I achieved a dream that I never thought I would get. You know, I'm from a blue collar town in West Tennessee, and I was one of 32 men in the world that did what I did and did it for a long time and was very successful at it. And if I can impart some wisdom, if they can take one or two nuggets from me in those prep sessions that helps them achieve their career, their goal and their career, I take a lot of pride in that.
I mean, I think it's great. I mean, that's awesome. Impactful. I mean, it's really impactful behind the scenes work. John, you've been really generous with your time. I do want to ask you one final question about, I would say, non-quarterback, probably the best draft pick for a non-quarterback in the last 10 years, just given where you got him. Derrick Henry, second round. I believe he was 22 years old when you got him. Could you believe that, you know, 10 years later, he'd be rushing for over 1,500 yards and 16 touchdowns and really looking as good as he did when you got him? Just what are your thoughts on how his career has unfolded? And are you actually surprised that at his age, he's playing at this ridiculously high level still?
I mean, first off, just an outstanding person. Just a really, really good human being. A great leader, not a rah-rah guy. But when Derek spoke, everybody listened. He had a unmatched work ethic. I mean, you can see his videos in the off season that he posts. Like, I don't even know what some of that stuff is or how any human can do it, but he does it. I mean, he's on a medicine ball with one hand and holding a 150-pound dumbbell with another hand. It's just like, who can do that, you know? And Derek had it. I mean, Derek's a unique build, right? I mean, he's 250 plus pounds and he's kind of high cut, right? So he's got longer legs. And if you can kind of get him going, and he's got enough speed to capture the edge, and if you get him one-on-one with the defensive back, they're roasted. And if you over pursue him and he cuts it back and you can get him on a defensive back, you're roasted again. So, you know, it's a testament to him, the way he approaches the game, the way he takes care of his body, the routine that he has. He is a great, great teammate. Never had any issues with Derek. Was the, you know, face of our franchise in Tennessee for a lot of years. And we got lucky with that one.
Must have done him some good to sit and kind of be in a tandem with DeMarco Murray for those first, couple of years that he was there, right? Were they overlapped by a couple of years, right?
Yeah, so DeMarco was there for 2 years, and DeMarco was, you know, DeMarco was really good too. That was, I think I traded for DeMarco, and Howie and I swapped fourth-round picks. So for like 9 draft slots, I got DeMarco Murray. Okay, I'll do that deal, Howie. You know, having him there, you know, with him, and then, you know, Derek always had a great relationship with every quarterback. He had a great relationship with Marcus, and then when we brought Tannehill in, you know, he developed a great relationship with Tanny when we made the switch to Tanny. Him and Ben Jones, an all-pro center that we signed, who was a free agent out of Houston, been one of the tough, him and Logan Mankins, probably the two toughest guys I've ever been around. But Derek could, he could just fit with anybody, and just a really, really good teammate. DeMarco certainly helped him, and he helped DeMarco as well.
I would not want to be on the receiving end of one of his stiff arms, let me tell you. Seeing those go off in the last couple of years, even as he gets older, I have no interest in ever eating one of those stiff arms or even seeing that guy barreling down at me, because they'd be picking me up with a shovel. John, I want to thank you so much for taking the time with us tonight to go over all this. You know, as a Patriots fan, it's great to hear, you know, the background stories of stuff that I would never actually get to hear. So again, I just want to say thank you again for taking the time for coming on with us tonight.
Yeah, it was great to be with you guys. We didn't get too down and dirty on the Patriots. That would probably not be podcast worthy, but it's I know where some of the stuff's buried.
We'll save that one for another day. So again, thank you again. We'll see you all next week.
See you guys.